Welcome to 3GT, a podcast where a pastor, parishioner, and professor have lively conversations on practical Christian living from a Reformed perspective. For more information, visit our website at 3GT.fm.
Welcome to another episode of Three Guys Theologizing, that is 3GT. Be sure to check us out at 3GT.fm. But today I am joining my cohorts, Barry York and Aaron Sams, and we are here to discuss another topic. And I am Kyle Borg, the pastor of the Three Guys That Are Theologizing. Aaron is our parishioner, and Barry is our professor, and soon I think we can start calling Barry our president. So are excited for that moment, Barry.
Yeah, that's still a ways off though. So,
all right. But today I'm going to come to you guys. I'm going to kind of set this up as giving you guys free rein to counsel me. And so let me set this up by saying I haven't talked to a lot of people about it. But one of the biggest tensions in my life is balancing, I don't really like that term, but balancing confessionalism with a sense of little c Catholicity. And what I mean by that is, on the one hand, I'm a pastor who subscribes rather strictly to a confession of faith, the Westminster Confession of Faith. It has 33 chapters. It covers topics from what we believe concerning the scriptures to the providence of God, the fall of man, sin, salvation, Jesus, the church, worship, to the last things. It's in one sense a very broad confession in that it's very detailed and very nuanced in certain things that I believe. And I hold very tightly to that. I think the Westminster Confession of Faith is one of the best explanations of what the Bible teaches concerning what we are to believe concerning God and what God requires of us. On the other hand, I struggle with a desire to be unified in the way that Jesus prayed in his high priestly prayer of John 17, when he prayed to his Father that his people would be one, even as he and the Father are one. I struggle with what we often call Catholicity, not Roman Catholicism for our listeners, but Catholicity simply means universal. And at the same time as being kind of this strict confessionalist, I at the same time want to find ways to be able to express my unity with other believers, but also the extent of that unity, which really is this thing that we call Catholicity, that Christ's church is not only one, but that it is also spread throughout the whole earth. That for my sake, you know, the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America is not the only church of Jesus Christ. And I find in my life that that's a tough tension to live in. Being very convinced and convicted of very particular and nuanced truths, but also desiring these things like unity and Catholicity on the other hand. So I'm going to come to you guys. I would love to hear both from a professor and president-elect standpoint, but also a parishioner. What do you guys think about that? How do you work that out? What do you think unity is, and how is it expressed? What is Catholicity? How can we, as Christians and as churches, work toward greater unity and Catholicity?
Well, one of the first things I would say, Kyle, is that that is a tension, a good tension. I think you're not the only one that faces it. We should have a sense of Catholicity. The Nicene Creed talks about the church, particularly the invisible church that spreads across the globe, as being one and holy, apostolic, but then it uses the word Catholicity. And again, a lot of Protestants get uncomfortable with that idea, but it's just the idea that the church isn't centered on one nation like it was in the Old Testament with Israel, but it's to all the nations, all races, all peoples. That's where the church is to be found. And so we are to really have a high regard for that sense of God's kingdom being expressed in different countries and in different branches that we might call of his vineyard, different denominations. We are to, if they have the gospel and believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and the scriptures, then we are to regard them as brothers and sisters in the Lord. But then how to get along with them, how to interact with them regarding certain issues, that becomes a little bit more difficult terrain to navigate. So it's one thing to know that there is the terrain. It's a whole different idea about how to particularly navigate it.
Yeah, Barry, when you're talking about, you know, creeds, that I love that we have historic creeds in the church, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed specifically, that define truly essential things like the Trinity, like the dual nature of Christ, like, you know, the resurrection, the virgin birth, things that are that set Christianity apart from anything else, and that things that set Orthodox Christianity apart from any other flavor that calls itself Christian. So I love that we have those historic statements that that do unify the church. So, and as you mentioned, you know, it has the word Catholic in it. I remember my son, the first time we visited a church that used the creed as part of the worship, and saying, you know, I believe in the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. But they footnoted it. It was nice because he actually looked down at the footnote and said Catholic equals universal. And so he asked me about that in the car. Hey, Dad, I was looking at that and I was noticing that. And he just wanted to talk more about that. And so we got to talk about the fact of, Kyle, what you were just saying, that, you know, one type of Christianity is not the only one that's out there. And there are, you know, aspects of our faith that we can unite around, things like, you know, the very important things like the Trinity and the dual nature of Christ. So, anyway, Barry, I just all that just to say, I wanted to reiterate my appreciation and love of historic creeds.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I was just going to say, we didn't really answer much of your question. We're just acknowledging that your question's a valid one.
That's all right. We did a whole podcast on our last episode, and you guys didn't answer a single one of mine. Right. So we got a whole nother follow-up episode we need to do on sanctification.
So, 7 minutes in, and I'm feeling confirmed that I have an okay question to ask.
Thanks. Yes. Well, I don't know if you're familiar at all with Al Mohler's attempt to try to help with this. He talks about theological triage. Have you men come across this, where he has first, second, and third order issues? I've found this somewhat helpful. So he just talks about, you know, first order theological issues are those that Aaron just mentioned, the chief cardinal doctrines of the Christian faith that all Christians must hold to. And there are people who name the name of Christ or who use the name of Christian, and we don't have to really worry about being in unity with them because they deny the basic Christian faith. So, if, you know, a Mormon, for instance, they call themselves the Church of Jesus Christ, but we know that they're not. And so we stand against those. And so that's the first order. The second order would be more along the line of denominational differences or distinctives. So he talks about, for instance, baptism being one of those. So you can, first order, of course, we're standing together, but a second order disagreements can still view people as fellow believers, even though we disagree significantly with them. So for instance, Baptists and Presbyterians have a huge difference but on the issue of baptism. And because
you're talking about the mode and the time in one's life of baptism, not the necessity of baptism.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So, because, you know, Baptist or Presbyterian would have different viewpoints of that, and it affects so greatly the life of the church and the way you view children and that type of thing, then it would be hard. It's not impossible. I know some congregations try to meld the two, but for the most part, Baptists and Presbyterians have to remain distinct denominations because of that. So that's second order. Third order are smaller things, where you could be within the same congregation as someone else, and have a third order difference. So for instance, it could be something theological such as, well, like eschatology. I know in my own denomination that I have men that I'm in deep fellowship with, but they have a different view of eschatology than I do. But it could go to other things as well, like certain Christian practices. For instance, head coverings. Some people believe that when you're in worship, you should the woman should have a head covering on. Others don't, and I know congregations where people of both of those conscience still worship together and hold each other in high regard, and so it's a lesser and less divisive order when we think about the third level. So it's basically, you know, the basics of the Christian faith, then what we might view as denominational distinctives, and then thirdly, more lesser doctrines and Christian practices would be in that third order. I don't know, so is that helpful to you, Kyle? I mean,
can I be honest?
Yeah.
No. Okay. No, it's not. I think that will probably be very helpful for listeners, and not to poison the well, but, you know, with all respect to Al Mohler, in some sense, didn't he pick the low-hanging fruit? You know, you think of those first-order doctrines. I don't necessarily agree, right? The Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, I delivered to you what was of first importance, that Christ died according to the scriptures and rose again. You know, Paul clearly recognizes this first order of things, which centers upon the historic person and work of Jesus Christ, which is according to the scriptures. At the same, you know, and then the second order of doctrines, you know, Mohler's example was baptism. But I guess the question becomes, if you're going to be applying this theological triage, how do you begin to discern what falls where? You know, so I would be a Calvinist, as a good Presbyterian is. I would agree with Charles Spurgeon that the right preaching of the gospel requires a preaching of Calvinism. Well, is that a first order of doctrine? Is that a second order where I can kind of agree to disagree with people? As important as it is, you know, it's, if I can say it, one of the things that Al Mohler belongs to is Together for the Gospel. And while I appreciate so much of the emphasis of what those men do, sometimes I feel like they just brush their very significant differences under the rug. I don't even know that all of them would be 5-point Calvinists. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the question becomes, and again, this is where I feel the tension, right? I have very strong convictions on these things. Mm-hmm. I have extremely strong convictions on what is commonly called the 5 points of Calvinism. I know not everybody's going to share those convictions, and I'll let their consciences stand or fall before God and their understandings of the scriptures. But how do you begin to categorize then what is a first order doctrine? Barry, you use the example of head coverings. Now, I agree with you. My wife does not wear a head covering. I don't think whatever is being talked about in 1 Corinthians 11 is a binding ordinance in the church. But, you know, I've met people who will raise that beyond a third issue by saying, look, you're in sin. Like, mm-hmm. if this is commanded by the Bible, you're in sin not to do it. And so, you know, Mohler can set out these three orders. My question then becomes, well, how do we sort out what belongs to a first, second, third order of doctrines? Is that a fair question to ask?
No, I think that's a great question. And I think that's part of his point, is that you have to work through that yourself. And again, he's using the word triage. You're out on the battlefield. You're a medic, and you're trying to make quick decisions on who you're going to treat and who you're not. And some of that is based on measurements a medic would have to just determine if this guy's getting ready to die. I've got to put my efforts here versus this guy's bleeding pretty badly, but I can wait a little bit because this is a first order priority. And so I think what happens is a lot of believers do take what should be, for instance, a third order level truth or practice. Let's say something along the lines of what we would view as a Christian freedom, and they begin to elevate it to something more of a second order and start creating divisions, perhaps in a congregation over it. I would think as a pastor, that's part of our duty, is to try to help people to determine what level these things should be. So though it's not a perfect model, I did find it somewhat helpful just to be thinking through myself. And I think we, in some ways, naturally, we naturally congregate in this way. You're in the denomination you're in, as I am as well, because these are the people that hold to things and see the things from the scripture the way that we do. And so much of our priority in ministry goes to this branch of the church where I can operate with a lot more freedom. But if I'm, if I'm going to make my life's issue to try to go over to this other church and take off their head coverings or whatever, you know, I'm going to go over there and, make that my purpose in life.
You're going to have other problems on your hands if you try to do that.
I'm just going to be a frustrated individual. And I think that's what a lot of Christians do. They, because of sin and because of perhaps not knowing how to read our Bibles and interpret them properly and those types of things, we can take smaller order things and elevate them beyond all proportion. So I think one of the important things in this discussion is to make sure that we're putting things in their proper place and growing in the maturity that helps us to do that.
And you would say, just for clarity, that in a sense, every Christian needs to do that for themselves, that as their conscience stands before God alone, that they need to discern from the scriptures what they believe to be first, second, and third order doctrines?
Yeah, and whether you actually classify it like that, that could drive me crazy trying to always put something in a, in a 1, 2, or 3 box. I don't want to go about life that way. But I do think in examining certain things, it might be helpful to say, is this something worth dividing over? So for instance, we've had discussions in past podcasts over if, there's a certain cultural issue that we're wanting to address, such as abortion. I am not going to worship with a Catholic. I can't. My conscience won't allow me to do so. But are there certain ways that I could participate culturally with a Catholic in order to stand opposed to abortion because they view life beginning at conception like I do? So I think these are the places where we have to work out our theology and how it's going to be practiced in the presence of others.
So can I give a case study and maybe you can walk through it with me, one that has actually plagued me for a number of years. Would that be okay? Or I'm putting you on the spot here, both of you. But
throw it out there. We'll either respond or not. We'll leave you hanging if we don't want to respond.
So one of the conflicts that I've often had is as one who holds to the Westminster Confession, I have a very nuanced view of the Fourth Commandment and the Lord's Day. There are any number of Christians, especially in our broader evangelical culture, who would see the Fourth Commandment as not binding. Well, that's something for Israel. That's an Old Testament law. I'm not bound by it anymore. If somebody were to come to me and say that of the Sixth Commandment, I don't know that I could enjoy any Christian fellowship with that person to say, I'm allowed to have adultery. Doesn't matter. I can go out and do it. That was an Old Testament law, not binding on me anymore. Should I have a similar reaction to those who would deny another one of the Ten Commandments and saying that the Fourth Commandment, we don't need to observe? Right. So I guess that's where how that fits into this discussion. On the one hand, here's a position that I hold very strongly to, but recognizing that there's many people in the church that don't. What does unity, what does Catholicity, what does charity look like in relation to something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, you have to, when we use analogies, we have to be careful that we're comparing apples and apples. If someone just says, well, I'm just going to go out and commit adultery, if we're using that analogous to someone not observing the Lord's Day, I would say you'd have to, that would mean that they're just rejecting the church and not going to go to church and all that. Then I could see you could categorize them the same. But if someone says, well, yeah, I'm going to worship on Sunday, but I'm also going to do these other things, to me, that'd be more akin to a guy who's a little bit loose in his morals and what he watches on the computer, so to speak, rather than maybe just chucking everything, chucking his wife away and going to another woman. So you just have to, I think, evaluate these things appropriately and really get at their, you know, at their heart, what they're really saying about the Lord's Day. But I would say we do have a duty to help people to see that the fourth commandment is still binding on Christians. It's still one of God's top 10 commandments that he's given to us. And so we need to do things to help people understand it. It is, you know, one of the commandments that's stressed in the positive. It's one of the commandments that puts a greater obligation upon people in authority than those under them. And so there's some nuances built into the commandment that I think we should work with as we're trying to help people to understand it versus, you know, someone who's cheating on his wife and violating the commandment on adultery that way. It's in a sense easier to say no than it is to say, yes, you need to be doing this and here's why, and guiding people into it. But if someone's practicing things, like a Christian is practicing things on the Lord's Day that they shouldn't be and clearly violating the day, like, you know, we've had people in our ministry become Christians and they work on Sunday and that was just something they've always done. You know, we teach them that they need, and a lot of times, a lot of people who are converted and are seeing our view of the Lord's Day wanted to start doing that, but if they didn't, you would have to teach them, and I think you have to work, you know, it takes time to disciple people, so you got to give them time and patience, but you got to be working them toward that goal. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but those are just some thoughts that first come to mind.
Sure. Aaron, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm processing right now. So this afternoon I was driving. I had to go observe a student teacher, and then I drove out here to campus where I'm recording today. And I was listening to a lecture on a podcast from a guy named Daryl Davis. Daryl Davis is an African-American man, and he's a professional piano player, but he wanted to figure out, he's trying to get to this the source of racism with people in the KKK. Like, why would you hate me without even knowing me? And what he ended up doing is he ended up befriending some very, very high ups in the Ku Klux Klan, became their friend, went to their house, invited them to his house, spent time with them, spent time getting to know them. And over the course of many years, some of these Klan members left the Klan because of his friendship, because of his time that he spent willing to listen to get to know them and to treat them like a human being. Even though he despised everything they stood for, he wasn't going to let that impact his opportunity to befriend them and to hopefully get to the bottom, find out what was making them tick. So as I'm processing, as I'm thinking through this, and listening to that, and I don't want to say they're the same thing, because theological issues are not the same thing as racism. They're related. These are matters of the heart. But I think that the way in which we approach the conversations is just as important as the final conclusions we have when we come to our conclusion. And so I think just taking the time to talk, taking the time to listen is really, really important. And not being quick to ignore someone because they have a particular position. There might be a time to do that. I'm not going to say there's never a time to do that. But I think our default setting should be that of charity and patience with people. I'm also okay with some ambiguity. There's a lot of stuff when I look in scripture and I understand how people come to their conclusions on things, but I look at it and I kind of shake my head and I'm like, yeah, I get what you're coming from, but it just doesn't seem that clear to me. And so I'm kind of okay with some mystery, okay with some ambiguity, and that's probably just a personality thing. So I don't have a great answer other than that's what's just rolling through my head right now as I'm trying to come up with a response to your question. How's that?
Oh, that was nice and that was very ambiguous. So wait.
That's
wait
what I was going for. Thank you very much.
So what about, I've had many thoughts on all of this, and, you know, would you guys distinguish between unity, union, and uniformity?
I think those are great distinctions, Kyle. I want to start with uniformity. I don't think there are any Christians on the planet who uniformly believe exactly what any other Christian believes about, about the entire approach to life and faith in general. Like, I don't think we could actually have uniformity. I don't think it's a thing. You can try.
I agree, absolutely.
But I don't think it's possible. So, and Kyle, what were your other two? Unity and...
That was good, sorry. Barry. So unity, union, and uniformity.
Okay, so union, that's to me, that seems like that would be, you know, joining along denominational lines. We are unifying around a confessional statement, around whatever. So these sound like concentric rings to me, Kyle.
They sound like where, first, second, third orders.
But yeah, I mean, I want unity with as many Christians as I possibly can. I mean, that is the nature of Catholicity, is it not? That we have some sort of unity, and our unity is in Christ, is in the Trinity, is in things that are absolutely, utterly essential, that if you remove any of them, you are no longer a Christian. So then there's, we can unite around common doctrines, around common documents, and it kind of gives us our identity as who we are as a particular type of Christian. And I think that's important because we are also different. We're going to have natural affinities to different ways things play out, and to hold too many of those things too tightly, I think, can get a little dangerous. But I don't think we'll ever have uniformity in belief. The scripture is not clear enough on too many things to have uniformity. And we process it and we think of it differently, and we just experience life so differently that there'll never be uniformity.
Yeah. Yeah. I bring that up because I think through this and wrestle with the tensions, I think that's so necessary not to confuse all of those, that unity doesn't always require union and unity doesn't always require uniformity. I've just recently was preaching through Acts chapter 15, where we see multiple disagreements arise, right? There's the disagreement about whether Gentiles need to be circumcised in order to be saved. The apostles, with unflinching, unwavering resolve, absolutely not. There's the disagreement about how to appease some of our Jewish brothers and sisters whose consciences are bound by old things, and you see some leeway being given there. But very interestingly is the disagreement that arises between Paul and Barnabas. This disagreement of preference. Paul says Mark is not qualified for the ministry. Barnabas says Mark is qualified for the ministry, and they part ways. They separate over that disagreement. And I personally don't think Acts indicates that that was a sinful answer, because I don't think unity always requires union and uniformity. And I think that's important. So,
yeah. And you wonder how much family had to do with that as well, since Barnabas and Mark were related. And again, that's just implying something, so we don't know for sure. But I think it is important to point out that as Christians, we're not always going to agree on everything. And I think the thing that I've just seen is I've gotten old. I think it's partly just being older, is how vast God's kingdom is, how there are some branches of it that are a lot different than the one that I'm in. But as you get to know the people, you see sincere believers, and you get amazed at some of the things that the Lord is doing through them or showing to them that you can learn from. You got to guard because, you know, one of the problems with trying to unite the church at times has been liberalism. We don't want to just get into a wishy-washy ecumenical type movement, but we still, when we see true, sincere believers, we should do all that we can to work with them and to learn from them, to encourage them in their walk as we hope they will do for us.
Well, that's good. Well, I think this is just a brief introduction. Like I said, I still feel the tension, how you hold very firmly to the things that you're convicted of, how you extend charity, how you strive for unity, how you strive for Catholicity in light of that. I think sometimes there's very easy, obvious answers to those questions, but for me, at least, more often than not, they are somewhat complex, but well worth thinking through. because Jesus himself prays that his church would be one. And we look forward to that day when that will be true, when Jesus does what none of us ever will be able to do. So, well, I think that brings us to the end of another episode of 3GT. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to head over to iTunes to subscribe to this podcast and visit us at 3GT.fm.